Welcome to the Iron Basketball Podcast, the Take Control Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. My man from the New York Post, Tim Bontemps. How's it going?
Well, pretty well, man. How are you?
I'm good. You're like the beat writer of the $100 million man right now.
that's one way to put it.
That was a you were there for Miami the last two games. You've been there for the entire Brooklyn Nets run so far. That was a rough one last night in terms of watching Deron Williams. He didn't look injured to me, but he just didn't look like there are games where a guy will go 0-for and it looks bad, but it doesn't look, you know, some shots just look off. Like, he just looked not disinterested, but just, I don't know, like not engaged, or just not, his head wasn't in it or something. Like, it, to me, it wasn't the ankles. Like, I'm sure his ankles hurt, but I don't know. There was something weird.
It was weird. And, like, even earlier in the game, at one point, I think in the second quarter, I tweeted something like, even though Deron hasn't scored yet, he's playing all right. Because he was playing all right. Like, I think he had 7 rebounds and 7 assists. He only had a couple turnovers.
Yeah.
And he was like trying to be aggressive. But he obviously didn't make any shots. And then as the game went on, you could see, like, especially in the fourth quarter, there were a couple instances where they got the ball and kicked it out to him. I remember one specifically, Kevin Garnett got an offensive rebound, kicked it out to him for a wide. He was wide open for a three. I think they were down. They're down a couple points, and he just immediately chucked it to somebody in the corner without even looking to go up with it. And the Nets made, the thing about last night's game was the Nets made almost all the adjustments they needed to from game one. They kept Miami out of the paint. They got a lot better play from their bench. Pierce was a lot better. Joe Johnson was hitting shots. Like, everything was set up for them to win that game, and he came up flat and, you know, didn't score. And, you know, in a game where they're basically dead even going into the fourth quarter, if your franchise player doesn't score, I mean, you know, that's why you come home down 2-0 instead of coming back with the series tied. And, you know, if they came back here with the series tied, who knows, it could have made this really interesting. Now they have to beat Miami two games in a row to make it interesting. That seems like it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, that's actually a great point about that. He had that wide open. I think he kicked it to, it was either Joe Johnson or maybe it was Alan Anderson in the corner.
I was going to say, I think it was Alan Anderson.
Yeah.
That's what I couldn't remember for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the play that really stood out to me. It's like, all right, if you aren't going to pull the trigger on this shot, like, you know, you have to pull the trigger on it. I mean, he's a great shooter. You have to shoot that ball.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Even a game where your shot's clearly not going, you haven't hit anything, that's something where I've always been, I mean, you know me, I've always been a fan of that mentality of, like, you shoot your way into a slump and you shoot your way out. Like, Ketino Mobley was one of my favorite guys because he didn't care what his last shot was. He always assumed, like, his mentality was, I think he would say, like, I always assume my next shot's going in, which is kind of, when you're a really good player, that's what you have to do. When you're a franchise guy, like, you really can't shy away from that. And maybe the ball just didn't feel right in his hands. That happens sometimes, but God, I mean, he was so open. And I feel like when he kicked it to Anderson, Anderson was fairly covered, right? I mean, it's not like Anderson was all that wide open.
It wasn't like, oh, let me swing it for a better shot. It was like the same shot or maybe a slightly worse shot.
Yeah.
And it just was, I mean, look, this is a guy who, you know, scored 57 points for the Nets in a game during the lockout season. He hit, I think, 9 threes and a half in a game last year at home. He's a great shooter. I mean, this is a guy who is a legitimate 40% shooter from three. Like, he has to take shots like that, especially against a team like Miami, where if you get an open look with the way their defense rotates, you have to take it, especially in the fourth quarter of a game like that, where, you know, really, you know, you could make an argument their season was on the line last night. If they win that game, this series looks totally different. It's 1-1. They got a chance you think they're going to win at least one game at home, and then it becomes a best of three series, and you got a chance. You never know what happens. Now, you know, you got to win 4 out of 5 games against a team that's got LeBron James on it.
Right.
So the chances of that happening are pretty slim.
And that's the thing, too, is, like, this team, especially against the Heat, like there was the whole 4-0 thing in the regular season, and they kind of, you know, whether anybody believes in that or not, if they believe in it, that's important, right? And for them to get a split there, especially like the game was so close until, you know, the last 4 minutes of the game, any kind of momentum swing there, any kind of push you can put them, you just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, you give KG and Pierce, like, regardless of how they've looked in the series, like, Pierce has looked okay. KG's looked really bad, at least scoring the ball. Right. He's looked uncomfortable. But if you give those guys a little bit more confidence than before, a little bit more, you know, bravado or whatever you want to call it, like, it just, that can build. Like, I don't think they had a chance of winning the series, but you can push it. And if you push them, you know, I don't know, maybe Dwayne Wade goes down with an injury. Maybe Bosch goes down with an injury. You know, like, you never know what's going to happen. And it's moments like that where you look back and it's like, not only did Deron Williams, who used to be a great point guard, not come through and not even want to take the shot, but it, like, we kind of, at least I've forgotten during the regular season, because, you know, KG and Pierce and Joe Johnson, all this stuff, like, Deron is their best player. Like, he is their franchise guy. Like, even if you take the contract out of it, like, he's their guy. And for your guy to not be willing to step up in that moment, it's just deflating.
Well, I almost wonder if he is their guy anymore. I mean, I know we've talked about him before. Joe Johnson, to me, has gotten so little respect over the last, say, 5 years of his career between Atlanta and Brooklyn. I know he's got signed to a contract that is over market value. However, as I think we've already probably talked about on this podcast, he didn't write up the contract.
Right.
He signed it.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, like, last night, to me, there were three elite players in that game. Because Wade, in my opinion, was not very good most of the night. You had LeBron, who was typically great. Chris Bosh was great. And Joe Johnson was great. Like, in the second half of that game, when the Heat put the pedal down and tried to pull away, Joe Johnson raised his game to that level and started making some really tough shots and kept the Nets in that game. Nobody else did. And, you know, this was supposed to be Joe Johnson, Deron Williams, and Brook Lopez. And then you bring in Pearson Garnett to kind of supplement that, and you sign Andre Kirilenko, and they later trade for Marcus Thornton, and you have Mirza Tvonovic. So you have these guys, you have this depth around that. Obviously, Brook got hurt, so that's not his fault. But, you know, so then you come into the series, and you think, all right, if Joe and Deron play like they did a lot of the Toronto series, you've got a chance to, you know, maybe give these guys a run. And like you said, get it to 6 or 7 games. Like, I thought the series would go 7 games because I thought the Nets match up well with them, and I still do, and I do think they match up well with them. And I thought they could win a couple games and make it interesting, and I thought Miami would win in the end because they have LeBron James, but, you know, I thought they could really give them a run. But, you know, the weird thing is, like, Deron and Joe played great in game one. They were the only two guys that really showed up in the game. So if Deron played like he did in game one again in game two, it's probably a 1-1 series. But, you know, the way it worked out, they really, like you said, in that spot, they needed him to play well. And because he didn't, you know, now you're staring at a 2-0 deficit. And, you know, if you don't get both these games in Brooklyn tomorrow and on Monday, then, you know, the chances of you trying to get out of the second round when they're 3 in a row against the Heat are, you know, pretty much nil at that point.
Yeah, and looking at the point guard comparisons, like if you combine the superpowers of Norris Cole and Mario Chalmers and compare it to Deron Williams, like they've doubled his point total in the first two games. Like they've scored 34 points, he scored 17, and all that came in the first game, and obviously it's skewed because he had one horrific game. But I mean, they just can't, you can't, and I love Mario Chalmers. I actually think he's really good.
He's definitely underrated.
Yeah,
he's
underrated. Like when he talks about, oh, I'm a top 10 point guard in the league, people laugh. But I really think like, okay, if he was running his own team, would he be top 10? No, but it wouldn't look ridiculous for him to say.
He's a good starting point guard.
Yeah, exactly.
In an era of a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's a guy that can play. Like he can flat out play. And Norris Cole's a really, you know, good backup, that energy guy off the bench. But like, I mean, Deron Williams is just so much better than those guys talent-wise, and he should be able to abuse them physically. Like, that's the thing.
Right.
And maybe that comes back to the ankles. Like, maybe the ankles just aren't right. I know he had an injection recently, right?
Yeah, he tweaked his ankle in game six of the Raptors series, and he had I think he had a cortisone and an anti-inflammatory just to make sure he'd be all right. But, yeah, like, you know, when I had to go through and do matchups and a prediction for the series. And, you know, in the matchups, the matchup was, like, in the Toronto series, it was Darren Williams needs to play as well or better than Kyle Lowry. And for the seven games, he did, and those are the four games the Nets won.
Yeah.
And in this series, it was Darren Williams needs to dominate his matchup with Mario Chalmers and Norris Cole because, like you said, I agree with you. Mario Chalmers is a nice player, but Darren Williams is supposed to be a lot better than a nice player.
Right.
And that's a matchup that if you're looking at it on paper, you think, all right, the Nets should win that decisively, and that could be the difference of winning another couple games in the series. Well, you go through the first two games, and even though he played well in game one, you would say it was probably a draw at point guard, and yesterday was a decided loss, and they're going to need a miraculous series of events to ever beat the Heat if, you know, they're at a loss at the point guard spot.
Definitely, and I guess for the team morale, I mean, this is a veteran team. I'm sure they don't get too low with this stuff. KG had some comments about how he needs to be better. You know, you wrote about Darren Williams as well. In terms of, like, I guess the team psyche right now, there's got to be a huge difference between what you saw against Toronto and then what you've seen after the first two games, right?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, you know, they're kind of a funny group in that they have so much experience that nothing really phases them. Like, they, you know, even when they were down 3-2 to Toronto, they weren't fazed by that. It was just, all right, we have to go home and win game six, and then we're going to go win game seven. And, you know, I think part of that was because going back to that series, the second half of game five, they made up a huge deficit in the late third and into the fourth quarter, came back from 26 down to tie the game. And, you know, really, if Andre Blatch hadn't made one of the worst passes ever, which wasn't even necessarily his fault. I mean, he tried to rush a pass.
Yeah.
I mean, it just happens. But if he'd have hit, ironically enough, Darren Williams at the top of the key, he had a wide open three to win the game. It could have potentially happened to go home with a win in that game anyway. So I think that might have been partly why they were confident. But, you know, all season, even going back to when they were terrible the first couple months, they never really wavered. There were brief moments where, especially during the year, where things look like they might get a little shaky and guys started to waver a tiny bit. But, you know, especially once they started to figure things out in January, they've done a nice job of staying level-headed. And I know they're that way after that game. They took a lot of positives out of it. You know, they saw the way they played overall. They saw the way their bench responded. You know, they saw their defense did a lot of the things they wanted to do against Miami. But, you know, I think their hope is that going forward, they're going to get games like game one from Darren Williams as opposed to game two. And if they do, they think they can still make things interesting.
That Toronto series was kind of fascinating because it really did seem to come down to, all right, is Joe Johnson going to beat DeMar DeRozan tonight, and is Darren Williams going to beat Kyle Lowry? And I thought the cool thing was the Toronto environment was so crazy. I mean, you would know better than me.
Unbelievable.
Because you were there.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, like, it was so crazy. But then, like, that's why – and it's really, like, kind of encompasses that game one of Pierce yelling, this is why I'm here, this is why they brought me here, of you have – a chaotic environment that, you know, you got 20,000 people in the building, 10,000 people outside, like, just crazy, crazy bloodthirsty environment. And yet you have these, you know, 12 guys and really like 7 or 8, because that's what the rotation is, just, you know, kind of on their own dealing with that environment. But that's why they did bring those guys together, because of that veteran experience. Like, that's not going to phase them. What was it like seeing them kind of embrace that environment?
That Toronto environment was insane. I mean, the Raptors, I mean, anybody who writes about the NBA knows about how insane the Raptors fan base is.
Tweet one negative thing about Amir Johnson and just see what happens.
Or not even anything to do with the city. You can anything at all. It's not just Amir Johnson. It's literally if you say anything beyond the Raptors are the world's greatest team and every player on their team is going to the Hall of Fame, you get bombarded with criticism. And I love Toronto. I love their fans. I grew up in Western New York State, so I think I was 10 when the Raptors were starting. Like I grew up not rooting for the Raptors, but I paid attention to them, and I know what the fans are like there. I know how much they want the team to be good. And so all that stuff that maybe on the internet manifests itself in ways that isn't the most fun sometimes, it really comes through in the arena and outside. I mean, the arena for game one and specifically the end of game seven was as loud or louder as any arena I've ever been in, including last year in San Antonio during the finals. Like, it was absolutely insane. And all the guys, and you're talking like guys like Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Darren Williams, who played in Utah, which is a crazy fan base, and Joe Johnson, like these guys who played on teams that have made deep playoff runs and won championships, were all kind of in awe of the atmosphere there because it was just absolutely insane. And, there weren't many teams, and you even saw them. Like, Game 7, the Nets had a 9-point lead, or 8- or 9-point lead with 3 minutes left, and it looked like they had it in the bag. And that crowd got so insane that it almost willed Toronto all the way back to win the game. I mean, it got basically within one, they got down to that one last possession with 6 seconds left when Kyle Lowry had the ball in his hands, and, the Nets smartly knew he wasn't going to pass the ball to anybody.
Right.
Surrounded him, and he flung the ball up in the air. But, that crowd basically willed the Nets to miss a couple free throws and willed that team back into the game. It was remarkable. But at the same time, if they weren't playing a team like the Nets, like let's say they had gotten the Wizards in round one, Toronto would have won the series. I think those teams are even. I might even say Washington's a little better. But a team that didn't have the extreme amount of experience the Nets had would have lost there because that place was it was honestly as good a crowd as I've ever heard anywhere in the league. And it was really remarkable. And to your point, like, game one, the crowd's going nuts. It's their first home playoff game and 7 or 8 years, and Paul Pierce hits 3-4 crazy shots in a row in the last 2 minutes, and that's why they win the game. And that's basically why they won the series. So, it was really fascinating to kind of watch that dynamic play out and see and kind of see, like you said, the stuff that they brought them to Brooklyn to do, Pierce and Garnett, and the other veterans they have. Like, it was kind of fascinating to see that kind of manifest itself in a series like that.
I've noticed this in the first two rounds with this team. What is it, just that he didn't get a lot of time due to injury this year? Like, how did Kirilenko kind of play his way out of the rotation?
It's been very interesting to watch. I'm an unabashed fan of his game. I always have been. He's one of my favorite. He's always one of my favorite players to watch. I know you appreciate the way he plays from watching him last year.
Definitely.
I think I didn't get the chance to go to Jason Kidd's press conference last night because you kind of have to choose where you're going to be at one of these postseason games, as you know. And I had to be in the locker room to make sure I got Darren Williams.
Right.
If I had to guess, I think the reason they're not playing him and he hasn't played much is he just can't really shoot.
Yeah.
And the way the Nets are playing now, they're kind of playing this 4-out, 1-in system. And the only way it's the way it's going to be most successful is if you've got four shooters out there with a big. Now, the thing I'd be curious to see, because, I mean, they got better minutes than Mason Plumlee yesterday, but, you know, Garnett has not played very well. Flatch was briefly good in game one. He had a terrible game yesterday. I would be curious if they would play Kirilenko at center and just have him be the inside guy and just, you know, move the ball through him at the high post the way they're running their offense anyway, and, you know, just try to set up their team that way and not have a traditional big man out there, because they, you know, don't really need one going up against the Heat. But I think because of Miami's, and especially I think because of Miami's defense, as you know, the way they trap and rotate and they try to scramble the ball, I think the Nets are thinking, if we can rotate the ball around the perimeter and get guys open looks, that's the better way to go. And when you see, like last night, they played Mirza Teletovic 20-something minutes and he hit six threes, I mean, it's hard to fault kid for going that way if Teletovic is going to knock down threes like that. Then it's kind of a no-brainer that that's probably the right choice. So I've been a little surprised at how little he's played in the postseason, to be honest, but I think if you look at it through that prism, you can at least see the thought process and why they're going that way.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that was the adjustment I was going to bring up. It's like, what about Kirilenko at the five? Because, and you can even play him with Teletovic. You can, because you're still spreading right. The floor with that shooter. And Kirilenko is, like, if you have him as the one man in, his hands are so good. He's such a good passer. And at least what I noticed last year, I mean, he hasn't played a whole lot this year, but what I noticed watching him live last year is this guy moves around the restricted area as well as any player I've ever seen live. I mean,
so good.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like, it's not just backcourt, or it's not just like backdoor cutting. Like, it's just like this circling under the basket that he's just he just understands the spacing so well. And then, like you said, with the high post, like, there's not, I mean, other than KG, there's not a better passer out of the high post on that team.
No. And he, the thing that's, I mean, like I said, again, I'm speaking to somebody who's always been a fan of his, but his interior passing is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, not only does he move around well in the restricted area, which he does, but he always seems to know the right place to put the ball for a guy to catch for a layup. And I'm talking, like, not like passing in from the high post. I mean, like, there's three guys around him and this other guy in the Nets, and he manages to get the ball to his guy in the right spot for an open layup. Like, just stuff that you just normally shouldn't be able to do. And it's, I agree. I think that's something that they tried briefly in, I think in the last game they played against the Heat, the regular season, they had the two of them out there together. And I think they might have did it a little bit in game one. And I wouldn't be surprised if they tried it more as the series progressed, especially if, you know, their bigs aren't giving them better minutes than they have in the first two games.
I'd love to talk about how much I love Mirza Teletovic, because
I've been waiting for you to talk to me about this all season.
This guy, all he does is take threes. 64% of his attempts in his career, and it's only 2 years, 64% are threes. 66% of his attempts in his postseason career are threes. Like, all this guy does is take threes. He's got such a quick release, such a compact shooting motion. He's deadly. I mean, this guy is just filthy deadly from downtown. And I love a guy that just comes in and his sole purpose is to chuck from outside. Like, he's such a better version of Steve Novak.
Yes, and he didn't get a chance to play a lot last year because the Nets were playing. You know, the Nets last year played a traditional two-big system.
Right.
And they started this year playing that way. And I always thought if they played that way, there wasn't a way to fit him into the lineup, because he's not big enough to be a regular power forward in that kind of a system where you're, like, banging on the post and you're operating that way. But He's a lot like Boris Diaw in terms of, they're not really the same player, but in terms of his body size and the way, like, his body type and the way the way he kind of positions himself, I noticed the Nets have thrown him on LeBron a decent amount this season, and he kind of has the same effect on LeBron that Boris does. Even last night, LeBron doesn't really know what to do with him. He just kind of ends up settling for jumpers because he's 6'8", 240, and he'll be a little physical on defense, and he'll kind of keep him out in front of him, and it'll make him shoot it, which is a win with LeBron. So, but ever since that switch to this smaller lineup back in January, and they put this, they kind of switched this one true big, whether it was Blatch, Plumlee, or Garnett, and then surrounded him with shooters, that's the kind of system where Mears is going to thrive, because, like you said, he has no conscience.
At all.
He has less of a shooting conscience than any player in the NBA. I've watched every game the guy's played as a pro the last 2 years, and when he comes into the game, he has one thought, and that is, if I have a fraction of a second to get a shot up, I'm getting a shot up. It doesn't matter if it's 35 feet away. Doesn't matter if there's 23 seconds on the shot clock. It's, if I have an open look, I'm going to shoot it every time. And the thing about him that always is amazing to me is, half the time at least, it feels like he's not even anywhere remotely on balance when he's shooting the ball. But he'll come off a screen at the top of the key and catch the ball. And, you're a shooter. Normally, a guy will, stop for at least a split second and square up to the hoop and shoot it. When Mears catches the ball, he keeps running and shoots it while fading to the left or the right, depending on which way he's going. And it still goes in. I have no idea how he does it. I'm constantly thinking he's just going to airball it because he's falling off to the side, and how is that going to be anywhere near the rim, and it just goes in. Or he'll catch the ball, and before his feet are even touching the ground, he's already going back up again to shoot it. The ball's in his hands for half a second and it's up. He's a very fun player to watch in that respect. If you give him any space, like last night, he gave him a little space to start, and he knocked out a couple threes, and we all just started waiting for heat checks. And sure enough, a couple possessions later, he comes down and he catches the ball in a fast break about 27 feet away from the hoop, and it's immediately up, just without even a thought. And we were all just kind of laughing because we were waiting to call when it would happen. He's a fun guy to watch. And to say he's a better version of Steve Novak is pretty apt, because he really can shoot it about as well as Novak, but he also can put the ball on the floor and get to the rim. He's big enough and strong enough to play a little defense. He can handle the ball a little bit. So he really has developed in his second year here into the kind of player I think they envisioned when they originally signed him.
Yeah, and I think that the balance thing is a great point, because he's one of the few guys where he never looks like he needs to be balanced when he takes the shot. He really can, as long as his release point is the same, he's one of the rare shooters where it doesn't matter what the rest of his body's doing. It doesn't matter what his base is like. It doesn't matter, if he's squared up. As long as his release is at the same point, it's this weird muscle memory thing with him. And he takes it from all kinds of body momentum angles to make up a thing that nobody else would consider a thing. Yeah,
it's so funny to watch.
I like to chuck up a shot or two.
We've played pick up before.
Yeah,
I know this.
He takes shots that even I'm like, oh Jesus, what are you doing? But they're pure.
Right. Yeah, they are. And he's got an impeccable motion. His shooting motion is just perfect. It really is. And that's probably why he can be falling over and still knock down shots, because he's so fundamentally sound mechanically. But
yeah.
He's a very fun guy to watch, and sometimes he can get ugly, because if he isn't making shots, to your point about Coutinho Mobley earlier, if he's missing shots, he's never going to pass up the opportunity to shoot another one.
Right.
He's constantly expecting the next 10 shots in a row to go in.
Yeah.
But if he does get it going like he did last night, you know, he can really change the game.
And I think with him, it's the Steve Novak comparison is people, I know they're already, well, actually people saying, well, if Novak shoots a higher percentage, it's the way they're used. And he's right. He's more versatile in that way because he will take more shots and yeah, he ends up shooting a lower percentage because of it. But the threat is similar. The threat is similar and yet it's heightened because he has less of a conscience.
He can do more.
Yeah, he can do more.
Sure.
Steve Novak's
an elite catch and shoot 3-point shooter.
Right.
Steve Novak can't dribble once and get a shot off.
Right.
That's the difference. Yeah. To your point.
I've also enjoyed this season just how much LeBron seems to be annoyed by him. And I'm not an anti-LeBron guy at all, but I do find it funny that this random specialist shooter and I love the Boris Diaw comparison on defense because it, you know, Diaw is a better defender, obviously, but Teletovic.
Well, I just meant against LeBron. It was funny. Like I was thinking about it last night during the game. It had the same kind of effect as when Pop threw Diaw on LeBron in the finals. It was like LeBron didn't know the right way to attack him, and he just kind of hesitates and shoots jumpers.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird.
I don't really get.
He's kind of like a weird wide body, and he's not a good defender, but he manages to get in the way.
Right, he's quick enough. He's quick enough and strong enough that he can kind of wall off LeBron initially, and that sometimes is enough to make him shoot jumpers. Which, not that there is a way to guard LeBron that's going to win in the end, but at least that's the best case. The best case scenario.
And LeBron really is getting annoyed by him. Like, he got annoyed in the regular season last night, and I don't know, like, LeBron just kind of seemed to, at one point, like, he's really been into, like, showing people he's stronger than the Nets in the first two games, and he's stronger than Teletovic, but he's also, Teletovic is just kind of like, all right, I'll slap at the ball whenever. You know, like, he's gonna hack him if he needs to. He's gonna try to annoy him. And it gets to him, and I don't know that you want to piss off LeBron, but it's amusing to see like I think he either got held or maybe he got slapped or something by Teletovic and started like pointing at the referee at one point, like saying like you gotta watch this.
That goes back to the Nets had 3 1-point games against the Heat this year that they won.
Yeah.
And one double overtime game, which goes to the point that as everybody, including the Nets, to their credit, said leading up to the series, the 4-0 sweep didn't really mean that much.
Right.
Beyond the fact that both teams had totally different lineups in basically every game. But the double overtime game at home, LeBron went up for a layup or a dunk on a fast break. It was on a fast break. He was either trying to dunk the ball or lay it in. I think he was trying to lay it in. And Mirza gave him a hard foul. Like, he wrapped him up. And I didn't think it was anything egregious. I think he might have got a flagrant on it. But, I mean, it wasn't – he didn't try to decapitate him or anything. But, you know, in typical LeBron fashion, he got very upset and, like, tried to, you know, charge at or whatever. Like, they had a little scrum. And this picture popped up on the Internet of LeBron and Mirza both being held back by, I don't know, 3 or 4 guys each. And – Mirza just has this giant grin on his face.
Oh, he's just trolling LeBron. He's just trolling him.
Like, I can't believe this guy thinks I'm scared of him. Like, Mirza, for people who have no idea about Mirza, which they probably don't, he's a fairly anonymous NBA player.
He
grew up in Bosnia in the middle of the war.
Right.
And, like, dealt with all kinds of unbelievable things in his life. So, like, LeBron intimidates a lot of people. And to your point, like, a lot of that stuff that he does, to his credit, is to intimidate his opponents and kind of get in their heads. But if there's any guy in the league that's not going to get shook by a guy flexing in his face or, like, pretending to be mad at him during a game, it's Mirza Teletovic. So to go back to that picture, after the Nets won in Miami in April, the game when Mason blocked LeBron at the buzzer, Mason Plumlee. The next day we were in Orlando for a game, the Nets were in Orlando against the Heat. We were in the locker room, and The night after the game, like, the Nets landed at, like, 3 in the morning. And Mirza is fond of tweeting at, like, 4 in the morning. I don't know if it's because people in Bosnia are awake or what, but he tweeted out, he tweeted out that same picture from the first game in Brooklyn when they had their little scrum, because he had, like, 12 points or something in that game, and the Nets won. He helped helped them come back in that last win in Miami, and he had something about, you know, nice job sweeping the Heat or something, and, like, retweeted this picture again of him and LeBron, with him just smirking at LeBron while he wanted to allegedly kill him. And I joked when he was about it in the locker room. I was like, hey, nice job with that tweet last night. And he just started laughing. Like, he just doesn't, you know, he just doesn't care. And it is very funny. Like, I noticed that last night with LeBron, too. Like, it's really funny how mad LeBron gets at him and how little it bothers Mirza that he does, because most guys, they would get shook by it. He just doesn't care.
Right. I mean, as intimidating as LeBron can be, I would imagine when you're growing up with bombs going off left and right, you've probably...
Slightly more intimidated playing an NBA game.
Yeah, you've probably gone through more things than a big guy getting mad at you. He is great on Twitter. Like, he tweeted early this morning. Is not over, Brooklyn Nets, Miami Heat, and he tweeted his shot chart.
His shot chart, which was great. And I immediately retweeted it.
It's so good. He's so good on Twitter.
He really is. I thoroughly enjoy it.
Before I let you go, What do you think is the result? Like, are we heading towards a sweep? Do you think Brooklyn can rally in Brooklyn? Like, what would be your expectation for game 3 and maybe the rest of the series?
Well, I think the most realistic outcome is the Heat in 5 now.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to go 6 or 7, but I assumed the Nets were going to get one of the first two games. And after last night, It's hard to see the Nets winning both games. Now, I expect the Nets to win game 3 because they're going to be home. They're going to be desperate. Their season will be on the line. And I have to think that they'll win that game. And then, you know, the whole series will kind of hinge on game 4. If the Nets can find a way to win game 4, then maybe things can get a little interesting. But my guess is the Nets will win game 3. The Heat will find a way to pull out game 4 late, and then the Heat will close it out in 5 back in Miami. But that being said, like I said, if you look at game 2, the Nets made a lot of the adjustments they wanted to, and they worked.
Right.
And the Heat don't have, like, especially after losing to Mike Miller, Eric Spoelstra, the Heat coach, has loved to say, since before the series started, these teams are the two most versatile teams in the league. But the Heat don't really have a lot of options. Like, they kind of are what they are. And if all their role guys, like last night, the 5 guys who shot 3s besides LeBron, which was besides LeBron, Wade, and Bosch, which was Shane Battier, Mario Chalmers, Norris Cole, Ray Allen, and Rashard Lewis. Those guys combined to go 9 for 16 from 3 last night. So if those guys are going to keep shooting like that, they're going to win the series. But usually role players like that, even though Ray Allen's not a role player, really, even at this point as a shooter, but still, role players like that tend to shoot a lot better at home. So if they go to Brooklyn after playing really well the first 2 games and they shoot 30% from 3 or 25% from 3 for 2 games, then maybe the Nets can make it a little interesting. But yeah, I mean, I would say it probably ends in 5. It's probably 3 more very competitive games. The Nets probably lose late, close in a couple, and, you know, the Heat find a way to get it done.
You were around this Heat team in the playoffs last year, as was I, but you've been around them this year. Do they seem more focused, less focused, the same? I mean, to me, on the court, it's looked like, not that they're not trying, but they're not as engaged as we've seen them, and maybe because that's because the threat level isn't what it was when I was around them against the Pacers and the Spurs last year. What, do they seem like the same team to you, or is there a different mentality?
I just don't think they're as good.
Yeah.
I thought that all year. I mean, you look at their roster, and they lost Mike Miller, and they didn't replace him. Shane Battier is a year older, and clearly is near done. I mean, he had a good game one, hit a couple threes, but he's not the player he was 2 years ago, or even last year.
Right.
Haslam is a lot worse. Ray Allen has had a great couple games, not surprisingly, against Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, who, for whatever he wants to say, I think he wants nothing more than to beat them by a million points every game.
Right.
And understandably, after the stuff that's happened with them the last couple of years.
Right.
He's been bad. Norris Cole hasn't had a great year. Like, you kind of go up and down their roster, and they got worse from last year. And when you factor in the fact that these guys are coming off three straight seasons of, you know, deep, long playoff runs, one of those years being the lockout season, which that was my first year covering the NBA, so I didn't understand it at the time. But every year that I remove myself from it, I understand more and more how absolutely insane that season was and the things that these guys had to do to get through that year in terms of playing back-to-back-to-backs and 5 games in 6 nights and 6 games in 8 nights. Like, that schedule was at least a season, maybe
crazy.
More than one.
Yeah.
So you factor all that in, and there's a reason why no team has gone to 4 straight finals since the Bird-Celtics.
Right.
Like, it's really, really hard to play 100 games a year, year after year after year, and deal with the mental stress of that and the physical toll of that.
It sounds a little dumb to some people, but the Olympics matter. Like, throwing in that month and a half of what you've got to do, like, that throws guys off. That's taxing. Like, that's more stuff. Like, it's not as taxing as playoff basketball, but it's something.
No, and absolutely. I mean, you think about LeBron. You think about all the minutes that LeBron has played in his career. And then you think about all the minutes LeBron has played since coming to the Heat. You think about the finals run in 2010 when they lost. You think about the whole lockout season. They finally win their first championship. Then he goes right to the Olympics. That team was unbelievable. But, I mean, I know you remember, they got pushed right to the brink by Spain.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the Dream Team where they went there and they were winning these games by 45 points. I mean, yeah, they had a couple big wins, but the gold medal game was a nail-biter that went right down to the end, and they all exhausted every ounce of energy they had to win that game. So then you have that. Then you have last season when they were pushed right as far to the brink as you could go, first by the Pacers and then by the Spurs. And now you have this season where, you know, Dwayne Wade sat 30 games.
Yeah.
LeBron played as many minutes as ever, sometimes more. I mean, I was at the Knicks Heat game in April, and the Knicks are terrible. And, you know, the Heat were playing at home, and they were up by, I don't know, 10 or 12 in the fourth quarter. I mean, it was a fairly comfortable lead. It might have been 15 or more. And LeBron checked back in the game with 6 or 7 minutes left, and have to play in 36 minutes. And he played 43 minutes in a April regular season game against the Knicks. And, like, that to me was indefensible and inexcusable. And, some of the Heat, I said that after the game, some of the Heat media guys got upset because they were saying, you know, they disagreed and thought, well, you know, LeBron, the Heat don't really practice, and so that's their rest days. I was like, okay, that's fine, but minutes are minutes.
Right.
They add up. And you shouldn't be burning 43 minutes from LeBron James in an April game against a bad Knicks team. Like, he shouldn't have to play 43 minutes to beat a bad Knicks team. That's a bad sign. And maybe it won't matter, and he's so great that maybe they will win the title anyway. But Wade doesn't seem like the same player. The supporting cast doesn't see the same. And, you know, the fact that the East is pretty weak might mean that they'll be able to kind of coast through, you know, especially if you know, maybe if Indiana gets their act together, they could still be the challenger we all thought they could back in November and December and even into January. But, you know, it's still, I mean, I don't know what you think. I still think at this point, whether they play the Spurs, the Clippers, or the Thunder, I think they're going to play the Spurs, and I think they're going to lose. Because I just don't think, I think they got worse enough, and those other teams are the same or better, that I just don't, I don't think that in the end they're going to have enough to get this done.
Yeah, I mean, I think that personally, because it looks like the East is going to be such an easy road for them now, like unless Indiana has an exorcism and finds a way to become the team they were last year and even early parts of this year, I think that added rest and the minimized stress of that road through the East, I think that'll be enough to push them over the top no matter who they play. Like, I, assuming there are no major injuries, I will pick the Heat in the finals. Just because of the fact that
it's always safe to pick LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, they've got the best player in the world. I think Spoelstra is just such a brilliant coach. They've got a great team.
Oh, he's such a good coach.
Yeah, he's so underrated and underappreciated. And I think that because they're not going to have the same taxing road that they've had in the past, that's why I will pick them. But if they had gone through, you know, if Indiana it becomes a monster again and that goes seven grueling games, yeah, I might start to say the Spurs or the Thunder or I don't know that I picked them against the Clippers, but Spurs and Thunder, yeah, I would then have to think like, all right, this is the champion and not the Heat.
Yes, I think that's fair too. I mean, you know, and you're right. It could be the fact that the East is so bad that it kind of gives them the cushion they need to get through. But I just thought, even going back to seeing them in November, there's just something missing there. And I just don't think, you know, and Spoelstra's an unbelievable coach. I'm with you there. I think he's phenomenal. And, you know, I think Bosch is wildly underrated. But Wade, like even last night, you know, Wade got celebrated for hitting a couple jumpers early in the fourth quarter. But the Nets basically ignored him whenever he was on the court and said, you want to shoot 20-footers? Go for it.
Yeah, he was brutal the first three quarters of the game. And then I thought I liked his playmaking, and he got it together in the fourth a little bit. But he was pretty bad for a good chunk of that game.
Yeah, and he can't shoot. I mean, look, it's the same thing. It's been the same thing with him forever. And
right.
He used to be such an otherworldly athlete that it didn't matter. And he could just get by guys and get to the rim and get fouled, and he could overcome it. He's lost enough of a step now that he can't. And if that mid-range jumper isn't falling, then you could do what the Nets did, which is take two steps back and say, all right, Dwayne, what are you going to do? Are you going to shoot a 20-footer? Are you going to try to drive into three guys? Now, how do you want to do this? And, you know, the Nets probably aren't good enough to exploit that weakness to beat them, especially now. But, you know, they get to the finals and, like, let's say they play the Spurs. You know, the Spurs are going to do that. And you would think the Spurs would have enough weapons to take advantage of it and have enough to come in over the top. But, you know, like you said, the Heat are the best player in the world. And, you know, every time I see LeBron, I'm reminded of just how good he is. And, you know, Kevin Durant deserved to win the MVP this year. He had a better year.
Yeah.
But there's still no question that if you need to win a series, you're going to take LeBron and to be, you know, you're going to pick LeBron first. And, you know, if you say, I'm going to ride with LeBron until he loses, I think that's probably going to be a winning strategy.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and I'm excited to, once conference finals come, I'm going to get to travel a little bit. I'm excited to see him, but more importantly, I'm excited to see you, and I'm gonna make you do a live podcast. Well, not live, because it's still going to be recorded and then posted later, but we're going to do an in-person podcast.
I hope so. Hopefully I'll be able to see you. That would be fantastic.
All right, Tim, we can read you at the New York Post, follow you on Twitter, @TimBonTemps. Thank you so much.
No problem, man. Anytime.